You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit bpn.fm to discover more.
I'm Jamie Dumont.
I'm Rob Russo, and this is
The Fabulous Invalid. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, wow, well, it's Monday night and we are back at Orso.
Yes, it's the Monday before the Tony Awards.
It's the Monday before the Tony Awards.
And the Monday after the Drama Desk Awards.
Which we both went to last night.
Yes, yes.
We said that at the same time.
Did we?
Oh, yeah, we did. Yeah.
How about that? Yeah, and I have to admit, I slept in a little this morning because I was up late last night.
I know you were.
Celebrating the results, and you know, I was riding a high. It was hard to fall asleep.
It was hard to fall asleep.
I have to say, I went home and I listened to the prom cast recording from start to finish, which is...
Is that because I mentioned that I had listened to it for the first time leading up to going to the Drama Desk?
Oh, that's right. That's right. You had taken a break from
the prom. I had taken a break from listening to it three times a day, every day.
I had to do that last season from the band's visit.
Yeah.
I saw the show like 5 times in 3 months, and was listening to that cast recording nonstop. I finally had to like take a break.
Well, it's no secret. Well, it's now no secret to anyone, but we are seeing the prom again on Wednesday.
Oh, that's right. Yes, yes. One last check-in before the Tony Awards.
One last check-in. I think Beth Level, when we told her last night at the Drama Desk, looked at us like we were bonkers.
What? No, I thought she was excited.
Really?
Yeah.
I think she was afraid.
Oh,
I think she's now. I think she's now planning her escape from us.
It is all about Emma and not about me.
I guess I've already sort of let the cat out of the bag, but in thinking about the Drama Desk Awards last night, the sort of greatest surprise of the entire evening, for me at least,
for everyone.
Everyone, was that the prom won Best Musical.
Yes.
Which is so delightful and exciting.
Are you aware that you screamed like a girl when that happened?
I am.
Okay, good.
I am. I own that.
Yeah, I know.
That.
I know you do.
I was so terribly excited. We were sitting. It's a very, starry crowd. One of the cool things about the this award show, the Drama Desk, is that in the orchestra, it's a mix of all the nominees and the voters. And that's basically it, because it's Town Hall. It's a very small venue compared to the fact that it's, 100 and something nominees.
When you're in the hall,
mm-hmm.
when there's a surprise like
yes.
that, you weren't the only person screaming.
Oh, no!
You might have been the only male screaming like a girl in row L.
Right, well,
but
we were in row J, and you know it.
Oh, sorry.
So, no, but I immediately looked right across the auditorium to, where...
Do you like how I upgraded our seats?
What do you mean you upgraded our seats?
Wait,
no, JKL.
Oh.
No, you didn't.
See, I don't even know the alphabet.
Jamie doesn't know the alphabet. But I immediately looked across the auditorium to where the prom was sitting, because I knew where they were sitting. I'd, scoped everyone out throughout the evening. And Beth Level and Brooks, they all just shot up.
Oh, they were jumping.
It was thunderous. It was so wonderful and exciting. For those who don't know, the Drama Desk recognizes both Broadway and off-Broadway and off-off-Broadway shows. So the nominations in each of the categories are different from what are at the Tony Awards, which makes it a little hard for them to be predictive of what will happen at the Tony Awards. This year, it was Tootsie, The Prom, Be More Chill, but also Rags Parkland sing Songs of the Future, and The Hello Girls. Those were two productions that played off-Broadway and are no longer running, so folks don't even have a chance to go see them if they were interested. So without Hadestown... or Ain't Too Proud, which are the other, and Beetlejuice, which are the other three musicals that are nominated for the Tony Awards. It was an interesting category, and I thought for sure that Tootsie was going to win.
I think everybody thought.
I think
Tootsie
everyone
would,
did, right? Especially because it won Best Score and Best Book, which usually indicates
it won the two awards leading up to moment.
So hats off to the prom. I love that show. I've had such a love affair with it since we saw it back in, November? Of all the new musicals on Broadway, it's really the only one that doesn't have any sort of pre-existing brand around it. It was inspired by a news story, and that's it. It's had a real uphill climb throughout the whole season. So to see it win Best Musical, Outstanding Musical is actually the category, was really special.
So fierce, all in the past. So fast, I won't say it anymore. I know I am, and I think that's worth fighting for.
lot of great theater in New York. Hats off to the Drama Desk Awards for recognizing all of this wonderful theater and for putting on a great show. You know, it really has become more of a curated, you know, big deal of an event since you last attended in 1999,
oh,
right?
Well, you know, the thing I remember about going in 99 was it. There were lots of musical numbers. It was very musical heavy.
Yeah.
It felt like it went on forever. And what I really loved about, and that's just my memory, that doesn't mean that's actually what happened. But what I loved about last night is it was truly about the awards. It was truly about the artists. It was truly about the theater. There were maybe three performances.
Mm-hmm. And they were all great.
They were all great, but it wasn't, it never felt like.
Nothing was belabored. Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
Because it really wasn't, it wasn't an advertisement or a marketing tool.
Correct.
For
commercial.
Seeing shows.
Yep.
It was actually a celebration of outstanding work.
100%.
100%. And speaking of outstanding work, we have a guest joining us tonight.
Yes, wonderful guest. I can't wait to talk.
The fantastic actor and producer, Tom Hulce.
Wonderful. Should we...
I think we should have a chat with Tom.
Let's do it.
And nobody out there ever gets to define the life I'm meant to lead with this unruly heart.
Today we are delighted to be joined by actor and producer Tom Hulce, maybe best known for his work in such hit films as Animal House and the marvelous Dominic and Eugene, and his Academy Award-nominated turn as Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart in Amadeus. Tom is also a prolific Broadway producer, including the Tony Award-winning Spring Awakening, American Idiot, and this season's Tony-nominated smash hit, Ain't Too Proud, The Life and Times of the Temptations. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming down.
Thanks for coming. Yep.
And congratulations on your 12 nominations.
12 nominations.
How about that?
This Sunday.
Yeah.
We're just under a week away.
Yeah.
How do you feel?
I feel very lucky. not about anything particular to do with the future, but I feel like there have been so many moments in the progression of this show that have... unexpectedly landed in our favor, and we're definitely blessed with an extraordinary, once-in-a-lifetime group of people, and so I'm feeling really, really, really good.
Good. Well, we actually, some of those extraordinary people we've spoken to this year, so we chatted with Tara Rubin earlier on the show, and she said that casting Ain't Too Proud was one of the career highlights for her, finding the fellas to portray the Temptations was a real career highlight.
Yeah.
And Des Makanoff said exactly the same thing about his involvement.
Yeah.
It begs the natural question, how did this all come? How did you get involved? Where did this come from?
I think before Spring Awakening, which is when I first partnered up with Ira Pittleman to produce together, either right as that was happening or before, he had made a partnership with Otis Williams and Shelley Berger, the
manager
of the Temptations and the Supremes from the time that they had the level of success where they could even try to cross over to today when he continues to manage the Temptations as they continue to tour. They made a partnership to make a musical based on Otis's autobiography.
Wow.
And immediately it became clear that the songs were not available. And it was such an interesting situation. Legally, Berry Gordy doesn't have any hold on the material.
Really?
Sony Publishing holds the material. But nobody, out of respect for the enormous thing that he created and did at a time when that was just like crazy that there would be that company in Detroit with that many amazing artists and so on. I'm gonna detour for a second. When he came up to Berkeley to see the show for the first time, he talked at that time about how he had worked on the assembly line at Ford and how he took the assembly line as his model so that if it wasn't happening, it wasn't the car's fault. It was everybody else's fault, and it's how he could believe in the Temptations for 24, however many releases they had before they had a hit. And so what a remarkable thing he did. It would never happen now.
No.
Not in a million years. Mm. Gosh, why did I bring up Barry? And
because he didn't own the rights to the music.
Oh yeah.
Right.
So
but out
because
of respect
he wanted
for
to
him.
Do Motown,
right.
There was a hold on all of the catalogs of all of the Motown acts. Right. But he said to Shelley and Otis that the Temptations could be first after Motown. And so, you know, years go on and we get a call from Sony Publishing's lawyer, saying that he'd like to let us know that the Temptations catalog was becoming available and Barry had it put in the Motown contract.
Wow.
To protect that we would have the first window, if you will,
right,
of opportunity.
And what year was this, roughly?
That they became available?
Yeah, that Sony called you.
I want to say it's about four or five years ago.
Okay.
But actually, when they called us, there was still time ticking when they were being withheld.
Mm, right.
But the date was so we knew that would come, and we knew that we could start to make a deal and pursue it. And then Des was our first meeting of anyone that would help create the actual thing, and the only writer that we sent to meet him was Dominique. Mm.
So that's, I'm fascinated by that, because she's written a beautiful book.
Yeah.
She's nominated for a Tony, deservedly so.
Yeah.
But she's an unusual choice, and she was your first choice.
Yeah.
So how did that come about?
We knew who we knew with the sort of the writers that were successful enough. That we would know their work or have seen their work. And there were a lot of younger, newer playwrights that we really didn't have. And so to educate ourselves, we read a lot.
Mm.
But for me, two things happened that were significant. One is that an agent said you should get Dominique Morisot, and that agent did not represent her, nor did his company.
Wow.
And so that's always like
a
little flame that goes off. And Michael Friedman, who was so many people's advisor, and so many people's sort of artistic guidepost, or I don't know.
Guru.
And so I said, okay, this is what we're doing. This is who, and this is who we were thinking of at the time. And he said, you should talk to Dominique.
Wow.
Well, good thing you did.
And not a moment too soon, you know, as it turns out.
Right. And she's a Detroit native, too, correct?
Yeah. Absolutely.
She's written a cycle of plays about Detroit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I
so are you.
To talk about, well, I was in a whitey white commuter suburb of Detroit, and I left to go away to school before I had a driver's license, so I didn't really know downtown Detroit as much as I would have liked to. But one of those Detroit plays opens with a Temptation song, Maybe Ain't Too Proud to Beg, and that for Ira, that was like a sign.
A sign.
That was a big hello.
You have to listen to those signs, you know, when they come along.
I know you want to leave me, but I refuse to let you roar. If I have a plea for your sympathy, I don't mind, cause you mean that much to me. Ain't too proud to beg,
and sweet darling, please don't leave me, girl, don't you go.
It does sound like there was a lot of divine intervention, or whatever you want to call it, bringing everybody and everything together on this project.
Really, even our first meeting with Dez, he brought up the fact that he grew up in Toronto, and so he was in Detroit all the time because it's just whatever it is, an hour and a half away or 2 hours away. So he actually had a much stronger relationship to the place and the time and the music than I did living 45 minutes away.
Right.
And, you know, I was lying on my bedroom floor listening to La Boheme and trying to imitate Anthony Newley. You know, it's just
both very worth merit.
Great influences. Yeah, great influences.
Don't underestimate the power of
Not
Anthony
to mention
Newley.
The outfit.
Right.
Well, Toronto ended up being one of the pre-Broadway stops for Ain't Too Proud. And you ended up doing this tour, which was another sort of
this
interesting, unique way to bring it to Broadway.
Yeah.
Did that afford you a certain luxury in the process? Or was it sort of just the way that it happened? Or was that by design? How did that come about?
It was luxurious in the sense that it was very expensive.
It gave you time to fine-tune the show, though.
Fantasy was that we would work on the show in Berkeley and get it to the point where the work that we would want to do, we felt that we could do on the way to Broadway. And so imagine our surprise when there was no room at the inn.
Right.
And
an increasing problem on Broadway.
Right?
Yeah.
And at that time, I don't know if it's the same now because it's about 2 years later maybe. Yeah. But at that time, so many conversations had been had between theater owners with people who they had very strong relationships with about projects that hadn't even begun.
Wow.
But that when they were ready, they could count on having a theater. Mm. So it was worse than we anticipated in terms of what we could sort of see. But we knew that we had a pretty a significant to-do list. And so at the point that it became clear that we were going to have to wait, the idea that we would just sit became not so compelling. And so Jeffrey Finn, who runs the theater, all of the theater part of the Kennedy Center, had been in taking workspace in our office for a couple of years before he took that job. And so, you know, we would have conversations about the Temptations show and stuff, and completely hypothetical and about, you know, and geez, like, are you having a subscription season down there? And so he was our first conversation, and it felt like a good place in terms of the work that we wanted to do. The Amundsen in L.A. kind of customized a situation that was exactly right for us. They had lost
they had a
maybe
show.
Crazy For You.
Yeah, right.
Was earlier in their subscription, so they owed their subscribers a show because it normally wouldn't have been the right time of year.
Right.
And so we sorted ourselves out to go there, and it felt like, you know, Washington for gravitas and L.A. for showbiz.
Right. Or, you know.
Well, it's also two more examples of where the right place, right time,
stars
everything's
aligning.
Falling into place.
Yep. Yeah.
Because how would you have known that Crazy For You would get delayed or whatever happened to it?
Right.
And every moment of the show just seems to be happening for the right reason.
Yeah.
And sort of not out of your control, but it's like there's something guiding
something,
the process.
Yeah. Before we left the Kennedy Center, Bob Michael at the Schuberts and Desi said, let us know that they thought that they could help us.
Help you they did.
Right. Yeah, they certainly did.
That they might have what we need.
Right, exactly.
You are in the perfect house for your show.
Yes. Oh my gosh, it's terrific.
It's crazy. It was taken off the market, I think twice, because there is going to be a big construction project next door.
Oh, next door, that's right. Yes, that giant lot.
And something just didn't coalesce
right
at the time where they were wanting us to make a commitment. And so when they said that it was going back on the market, it was like, go.
Well, it's interesting. As you're talking through the journey that Ain't Too Proud took to Broadway and all these different decisions that came up along the way and stars that aligned, it makes me think about taking a step back, a bigger step back, what the role of a producer is in marshalling a project along from that very first idea 15 years ago to now a hit, you know, musical on Broadway with 12 Tony nominations. The term producer means a lot of different things to a lot of different people, and even within the entertainment industry, you know, a record producer does something very different from what a TV producer does.
Yeah.
How do you describe your role as a theatrical producer?
One way I describe it is that when I was in the acting portion of my career, I got to be the special child, and whatever problem I had was everyone's problem, and it was especially the producer's problem. And now I'm the adult and the parent, and everyone's problem is my problem. So it's an ironic kind of
it's cosmic justice, huh?
Yeah. Flip around. Yeah. Especially because I thought that the producer, when I was acting, I thought the producer was the person who was going to prevent me from doing what I wanted to do.
Oh, interesting.
And so the even more delicious cup circle that I'm standing there and know in all kinds of ways what the person across from me may or may not be thinking.
Yeah.
But I think, okay, just like, you know, bring it on. We'll get through the through. But I feel like it's so much of it is just problem solving. Mm. I think my favorite part of it is putting together the initial pieces of a project and then watching. It's so exciting because it's just so hopeful. like in the early parts, it doesn't matter if something, as long as you believe in its potential,
right?
Then it's just all fun and hard work and you know, maybe complicated decisions, but it's all to be revealed, and so part of that job is to help it become what it wants to be and not what I want it to be or this person wants it to be, but to be able to say that 3 minutes there, that's where it lives and build out from there. And you know, hopefully there are 3 minutes that
Yeah, so it sounds to me like, I mean, a huge part of being a great producer, which clearly you are a great producer, is having that perspective and that patience and that ability to really see the bigger picture and have the bigger picture in mind when you hit those snags or when something's not working or when you sit back and you say, oh, actually, you know, it's all wrong, but all the pieces are right. We just need to rejigger the puzzle, you know?
Yeah.
And that's sort of an innate skill, I would imagine. Certainly it's something you can practice and you get better at over time, but how much of it do you think is
an instinct?
It's instinct, I think. Right.
And to have a partner, Ira and I rarely agree.
Interesting.
And we have very different specific taste, but we both have great and common belief in things, And so, left to our own devices, we may go about things in a different way, but we've been able to build out of a common passion for something.
Is that how you overcome the idea that you rarely agree on things, but as producing partners, you have to navigate those tricky waters, correct?
Yeah.
So is that part of how you get through that?
It's a crazy situation because, you know, it shouldn't work, right?
Well, that's kind of what I'm asking, because you just described a scenario for disaster.
Yeah.
And yet you've produced some incredibly daring, successful, wonderful, original pieces of theater, which is hard to do.
Yeah.
So I don't know how you do it.
I think a lot of it has to do with our commonality as humans, maybe, and a feeling on both our parts that it's not personal,
right.
and I feel sure that he would say this as well, that a solution to anything needn't be the solution that we can think of. That the exciting thing is when a challenge has been identified and the solution is something that neither of us would have thought of
right.
on our own.
Right.
Or that neither of us would have thought of, and Des
right.
has the, you know,
has the
magic
answer.
Number, if you will.
It's that synergy that really exists, so has to exist in the theater for anything to be successful, right?
Yeah.
Which also, I think, speaks to what you said a moment ago, which is one of your favorite parts of it is the beginning where you're putting everything together. And I assumed part of what you meant by that was putting the creative team together, right?
Yeah.
Assembling all of those pieces. Yeah. That's the exciting part.
Yeah.
What is Des going to bring to the project? What is Dominique going to bring to the project?
Yeah.
What is, so, you know, and seeing that unfold, that's the thrill.
And we're very director oriented in that we didn't bring our creative team to Des. We asked him to propose to us and pushed back maybe twice out of all the decisions.
Right.
And it became a kind of thrilling early process. I have to say, there are so many days where it felt like it was clear that we were working with a collection of artists and that the conception of the piece, it's in black and white.
Yes, I love that.
There's four columns and a metal fence and two horizontal LED panels and a moving floor and Peter Negrini's awesome ness that lives contained in various pieces of all of that, but to that idea was from the very beginning, and that meant that there wouldn't be any clothes that looked like clothes that literally the Temptations wore. There wouldn't be that sense of outrageous color, or you know, nobody changes their hair. What a crazy idea for a piece that's got such sort of extroverted potential if you did something literal, but to choose and to frame it in the sense of a man who is looking back and asking, you know, was it worth it to lose his brothers in a genre that feels so known.
Right.
It was so amazing to watch essentially a love story amongst these five people and the challenges they came along the way, and we would all find it so unexpectedly moving, not necessarily on plot information, but suddenly just the five guys would walk towards the front of the stage in the rehearsal room, and the size of what was being tapped,
right,
against all odds with this kind of story was just heaven. Mm. Heaven.
I love that you say it's a love story. That's an interesting frame for it.
Yeah.
Because it is. It's also it's a family. It's a story, right, about a family, right? And it's also a story about survival.
Yeah.
It's like these are deeply personal things that everyone can relate to. And it's fascinating to hear you talk about how you strip away what you know about the Temptations, their outrageous costumes, their dance moves, because, correct me if I'm wrong, but the brilliant work of Sergio Trujillo is all his work. There's very little, there are very few steps that actually were the Temptations, right? So you're now talking about a different language altogether,
right,
in which to continue to tell their story.
Yeah.
So everything is new and fresh,
and
again, that helps you really focus on the story of love and family and commitment and honor that you're telling.
Yeah. And, you know, how crazy. They all keep coming back.
Right.
You know, and 10 minutes after they've kicked David Ruffin out in you know, almost operatic terms.
Right.
You know, we've had an intermission. Who knows how much time has passed. The first thing we see is that he's trying to get back in.
Right. Stealing a mic. Literally pulling a mic out of... I mean, that's... You know, it's funny and it's comical, but also there's a tragedy to it as well.
Right.
Because you see this man who realizes what's happened.
Yeah. Right.
And then everybody else is watching this.
Yeah.
We're laughing as an audience, but if you're really paying attention, you're watching tragedy in that moment.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. And it's very deceptive how you've done it.
Yeah. Well, how we the collective, with Ira and I,
correct,
being of support,
right? You know?
The problem solvers. It is really special, and I have to say, you know, as someone like we all do, we see, you know, shows constantly, right? 6 times a week sometimes, and as you alluded to earlier, you know, this is a genre or a form that people think they know. Mm-hmm. They have certain expectations walking in. And some people have a chip on their shoulder about it, right? Oh, you know, the jukebox musical.
Exactly.
I'm using scare quotes right
now.
And I'll admit, you know, even I have a little bit of skepticism when I see, you know, Ain't Too Proud, the Temptations musical, or the Cher show, or any of these shows coming down the pike. But it's a testament to the craft and to the team that you assembled that it does feel so fresh and so moving. And it's a fantastic story. And it's so entertaining.
Yeah.
And that, I think, you know, oftentimes we can forget about how important it is to just be entertained.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
In the course of seeing a show, you know? And it can be both thought-provoking and moving and entertaining at the same time. It can do all those things.
And the best moving floor use of any moving floor show ever. It is extraordinary.
Again, one of Dez's first ideas is about the number of times people are exiting and entering.
Right.
And so out of that organically came a very early conversation with Robert Brill, right? I want to say also that there's something that's so... one of the frustrations is exactly what you sort of defined, where there's an expectation... There's a lowered expectation, quite frankly. But as a result, people are so... surprised at the degree to which both the joy factor and how moved they are by things that it I feel like it lifts it even more because of the prejudice against the genre, if you will.
Right.
That and our company has such dedication, discipline, generosity, and feel so responsible for the quality of what they have been given the opportunity to put forward, that there's a lift that comes that's all on them. That's the secret sauce, maybe, of of the event. Just spectacular from top to bottom. Mm.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUPS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUPS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUPSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
I'm gonna do all the things Kiroka wants a man to do. Oh, baby.
Oh, baby.
I'll sacrifice for you. I'll even do wrong for you. Oh, baby.
The flip side to what you do is also there's a lot of unglamorous things about being a producer.
Oh, it's correct? Dog work.
It's numbers. It's as you said, it's problem solving. It's sort of being a father figure, for lack of a better way to put it. But I'm curious, because you started out your career as an actor.
Yeah.
You were a very successful actor. Now you're a successful producer. What do you know as a producer because of the fact that you are an actor that another producer doesn't know?
I don't know what other producers would or wouldn't know, but I know that the great gift for me for doing this work is all of the rooms that I was in and was in the process of something being made. And in some way, my backing out of acting and into other work was because I was finding the process of something being made started to become more compelling than living inside the story, even when the thing I got to do was so amazing in terms of the material and all like that. So I feel like it gives me entree into the room in a different way, and so I can be more adjacent to the work than a lot of producers are given the opportunity. So there's a lot about being in the creative room as an actor that is hugely useful. And in the way that an actor, I'll say for the most part, wants to find what the writer intended and bring that to life as fully as possible, not say, oh, well, this is what I want this part to be. It makes it very easy to be in a rehearsal room or in a process as a producer and say, this is what it feels, this is where it feels like it wants to live, and not have a prescriptive urge as much as a, oh, I don't know. I guess it's almost parental in a way to you know, you bring these like if I had children, I imagine that you bring these things into the world, and then you just do everything you can to help them become who they are.
Because you've been where they are.
Right.
But you also have to, it's that balance of having to figure out a way to teach your children or your art to live on its own, but also guide it with the experience that you have had from doing it yourself. Yeah. It also sounds like there's a bit of a process thing, is what I'm hearing.
I love is the process.
That's the thing that is, I think, the difference that you have that some producers may not experience or experience in a different way, which is that process, that artistic thing. And then, of course, you have to put on your numbers hat and be like, okay, we got to wrap this up because we, you know, or whatever it is. We got to figure this out because we have X amount of time. Or same thing, I would think, with that decision of, okay, so we don't have our theater when we wanted it. Yeah. So now what do we do? Do we go out on the road and risk that? Or do we lose our actors? That had to have been a tough decision.
Yeah.
Wearing both hats of being in the being an actor.
Sure.
And also having to think about the finances.
Do you use up your actors' enthusiasm if you take too long to, or is it all of that? I have to say, Ira was like so strong and clear that for him, he thought we needed to do the work that we wanted to do and then keep everything together in whatever way we could, so that we didn't lose whatever momentum we would have made.
Everything you'd worked for.
Yeah.
Right. That's a very parental way to... That is a very fatherly way to look at it.
Yeah. Papa was a rolling stone. Well, he laid his hat, was his home. And when he died, all he left us was alone.
Rolling Stone, my son. Well, now, well, he laid his hat, was his home. And when he died, of all he left us was alone. Thinking about your theater career,
yes,
you, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, made your professional debut on Broadway,
yes,
in Equus,
yes,
in 1974, which was the hottest play. Like
completely.
Ever. I mean, you know, some people credit it with reviving Broadway in a way, paving the path for all the great plays that would follow in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
What was that experience like, and how did that come to be?
An actress named Polly Holiday, who was doing a play at the Public Theater, written by Alice Childress, when I was an apprentice at a theater company in Florida called the Oslo Repertory, agreed to be in a workshop play that I was directing. I was probably 16 years old. And based on her sense that I had some kind of potential, she got the Public Theater to agree that whenever I came to New York, I went to North Carolina School of the Arts, and this, I was in school then. Whenever I came to New York, they would give me a job.
Wow.
Not an acting job, but they gave me a job. Which was huge, right? And so I got assigned to the costume shop, and my job was to take an envelope of cash and a list of things to do and go out and buy them. And so for somebody who didn't know New York City at all, it was like such a great way. You have to go to South Street, Seaport.
A scavenger hunt.
Fishnet and up to Harlem to get espadrilles and... It was 2.5 months before I knew that you could go from the Public Theater. You didn't have to go to Grand Central and take the shuttle. But the N and the R actually went on a diagonal.
Right.
Someone else that I'd worked with someplace else called me up and said, on your lunch break, come here. I'm going to give you my equity card. And you go in and you say you're me and sit right near the monitor and chat with them. And let them... So that when they call out his name, they wouldn't call out for the room to hear. They'd just say, it's your turn.
Oh, my
God. And the director was sitting at the open call. And if he hadn't been, I don't know what would have happened. But it was just a series of auditions. And then when the show was going into previews, like... it was probably a half page, but in my mind, there was a full page, front page of the Arts and Leisure of Peter Firth, who was starring in it and had done it in London, and I was hired to be his understudy. Wow. And so it was just like, it was so daunting. But because he had done it at the National, this is so weird. I was just out of school. I just quit school like a couple of months earlier when I got the job. But I used to study people's careers. I'd sit and read those magazines or the whatever. And I knew about Spring Awakening because Peter, in the same season as Equus at the National, was in a production of Spring Awakening. And so that was my beginning of even thinking about that. And I had a whole fantasy about making an opera out of it before all that happened with the musical. But they rehearsed me for a week with the real company.
Wow.
And let Peter stay home while all the other people got up to speed. While Tony Hopkins got up to speed. While Marion Seldes and Franny Sternhagen and got up to speed. So I'm standing on the stage of the Lyceum, like rehearsing with Anthony fucking Hopkins.
It's a pretty daunting thing.
Oh my God. I didn't know who I was. And from the back of the theater, I heard, "Boring, dear." Oh my God. And, I just like, I froze. And in my brain, God bless the drugs I had taken. The voice in my head said, okay, this is the way he talks to Anthony Hopkins. If he's talking to me the way he's talking to Anthony Hopkins, he must think I can do this.
Right.
Like, who the hell, like, of the 97 things that might go through your brain, the fact that the thing that would allow me to cope with whatever was going to be coming my way was... And they put me on in the previews before it opened.
Wow.
And all those people had read the New York Times, and they were really unhappy not to see Peter Firth, the golden star.
Talk about expectations, right?
Yeah. So all the actors sat on stage and came out at the beginning of the show. So after they make the announcement and everybody boos and some people leave, then I have to walk and sit in front of them. But they were very generous at the end.
Yes, of course.
You won them over. Yes. That's an extraordinary thing to be able, at that young age, to be able to say, filter out all the self-doubt and all the crazy that goes through your head and say, no, he's talking to me like I belong in the room.
Right. Yeah.
That's huge.
Isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, I was just so lucky. Mm.
That and you found Spring Awakening then.
Yes.
Isn't that crazy?
Oh my God. No idea.
Yeah.
Mama, who gave me? Mama, the angel. Mama, who made me so bad?
Mama, the weeping.
Mama, the angel. No sleep in heaven for Bethlehem.
I had an idea to either like do it in sort of Louisiana bayou country where it's swampy and people coming back from the dead and like that, or like a really conservative New Englandy religious community.
Oh yeah, very uptight and puritanical.
Yeah. So I'm sitting down with Michael Mayer, who I don't know. We're having our first conversation. Michael Cunningham had given me the rights to make a film or to try and put a film together of his novel A Home at the End of the World. Pre The Hours, and just to get to know each other, Michael and I are talking about things we like and things we do and stuff, and I said, an opera based on the Vatican play Spring Awakening. He said, oh, that's so interesting, because, 2 weeks ago, Steven Sater called me, and so I said, okay, tell me your idea, and if your idea, if I don't remember how I said it, but if it's intriguing enough, I'm not going to do mine until you do yours. And as soon as he said, in period, microphones coming out of things, I thought, okay, you do yours first. Because I sort of knew what mine were going to be like. It was just more about the setting and the thing, and what he had conceived. You didn't know what that was going to be. So they had just been like a couple of weeks into work on it. So for the years that they worked on it, Michael and I were also working on getting the film put together. And we did, we made it at the, it was after 9/11. And at that point,
this is the home at the end of the world.
Yeah, yeah. And Spring Awakening had been put aside because it was dark in the way it was dark, and 9/11 and blah, blah, blah. And Duncan did the score of the
film. Home at the End of the World, right.
And Stephen and Duncan wrote a song or two for it. And so when it opened, I asked them if they might want to invite me to sort of reinvigorate. And luckily they said yes and allowed me into the process, I think because we'd already been working together in a way that was that allowed the stuff that I knew and felt and all was everything was of use, because it was such a hard assignment.
It's the bitch of living.
It's the bitch of living.
Living in your head.
In your head. It's the bitch
of living and sensing God is dead.
It's the bitch of living.
We have two final questions, yeah. And one of them is as a producer, if there's somebody out there listening that wants to be a producer, what would you do? You have anything, any bit of advice to them? Run, hide.
Yeah. there's no rules. It's a crazy thing to do. Manny Eisenberg, who was Ira's mentor, and they did maybe a dozen plays together on Spring Awakening. He said, when we were at the Atlantic, he said, look, if you want to try and do it off Broadway, you're crazy. And if you want to do it on Broadway, you're crazy. So as fast as you can, you figure out which kind of crazy you want to be, and I'll help you in every way I can. So I feel like in any project, there's definitely ways in which it's crazy, and it's a crazy thing to believe in, and it's a crazy financial world around it. But there's an awful lot of really, really good stories and writing in one form or another that exists that doesn't require you to spend money. And so find, you know, it's so economical at an early stage to develop something. And so find something that you have a great passion for, and then find something that's available that you're it's so frustrating. It's very hard to get people to have any confidence in you. Go someplace where material is being made that you believe in, and mop the floor and just climb in whatever way that you can, and who knows what might happen.
The final question we do ask everybody, and that is, was there a show or a book or a movie that inspired you to want to be in the theater?
A musical called Henry, Sweet Henry
I believe it's on the wall next door.
Yes. Oh, there you go. Yeah. Came through Detroit on its way to the wall.
On its way.
And Alice Playton.
Oh, God.
Stopped that show once in each act. Do you know?
No, I don't know.
You're talking about where she comes out and begs the audience?
4 feet tall. Yeah. Probably had played.
She was the mother in Carolina Change.
Oh, okay.
Maybe was Dainty June the one you didn't like,
right?
maybe in like the original Gypsy,
possibly. Yeah, I think you're right.
But like, that was just like, oh my God.
Let's pass that for a poor little person who's lost out there somewhere in the cruel, cruel world.
It was Hal Prince's production of Cabaret. He did the stage version of Cabaret,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And I think that was the thing that just thrilled me. That wavy mirror that you looked at yourself in when you came in and sat down. And I don't know what it was in my genetic material, but you know, Melissa Hart played Sally Bowles, somebody named Robert Davio played David. I so cataloged all of this. But that was the first thing where in a sort of uber sense, no longer the right word, but overarching sense, that the experience of a piece of theater was so thrilling and entertaining and surprising.
Mm. And really affecting, really, really sort of changed the way you looked at things and felt about things.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Amazing. You've done that for us
yes.
on more than one occasion. So
thank you for inviting me.
Thank you
so much
down.
For coming. Yes. It's been lovely. It was a wonderful conversation.
Rob here with You May Be Wondering. Jamie and I started this episode with our download on the 64th Annual Drama Desk Awards, which were held yesterday, this past Sunday, per tradition, 1 week before the Tony Awards. If you follow New York theater news, you've surely heard about the Drama Desk Awards before, but you may be wondering, what is the Drama Desk itself? Well, the Drama Desk is an organization of New York theater critics, writers, editors, and reporters that was founded in 1949 with a mission to educate the community on vital issues concerning the theater by sponsoring guest panel luncheons featuring theater professionals, with the aim of prompting informative and stimulating discussions. In order to further this mission, the Drama Desk Awards were established in 1955 as the Vernon Rice Awards, in honor of New York Post theater critic Vernon Rice, who pioneered off-Broadway coverage in the New York press. They were later renamed the Drama Desk Awards in 1963 and continue to the present as the signature annual event of the Drama Desk, this year presented by Broadway News. What makes these awards special is that they are the only annual awards presentation that considers and recognizes productions on Broadway, off-Broadway, and off-off-Broadway, making for a combined roster of shows available for nomination that reflect the breadth and depth of the entire New York theater scene. As an example, this year's category for Outstanding Actor in a Play consisted entirely of performances from off-Broadway, despite the fact that on Broadway it was a banner year for new plays. And while just under 40 new shows opened on Broadway this season, the nominating committee of the Drama Desk considered over 260 shows from all around the city. There are also more categories at the Drama Desk than at other awards, including separate categories for music and lyrics, and additional categories like hair and wig design, projection design, and fight choreography, among others. Another notable feature of the Drama Desk Awards that might seem like a small semantic matter, but is actually quite meaningful, is that the categories themselves recognize outstanding artistry instead of, quote, the best. With a membership roster of only 130 or so members of the press, none with a vested interest in any outcome, the voting pool is also different from that of the Tony Awards, which has some 846 voters, including designers, directors, press agents, casting professionals, and managers. And so, after the Tony Award, the Drama Desk is probably the most prestigious award in New York theater. And it's not hard to understand why that is, given its impartial status, smaller voting pool, and wider scope.
In addition to its marquee award show, the Drama Desk does also continue to host an annual series of panels and forums created and moderated by Drama Desk members that offer audiences a chance to listen to producers, directors, actors, and other artists discuss their work. This season, I was a proud first-time voting member of the Drama Desk and was honored to join in celebrating the best of all New York theater.
Jamie here. That's our show. Thanks for listening. You can hear us anytime on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you download your podcast. The Fabulous Invalid is a production of O&M Etc. and The Fabulous Invalid LLC. And thank you to Orso Restaurant, Sean, the incredible staff, and Joe Allen himself for being so great to host us here tonight. Our theme music is by Lucky Chops. Today's episode was edited and engineered by Aaron Kaufman. Find us online at thefabulousinvalid.com and on social media at fabulousinvalid. And on iTunes, Spotify, and wherever you find your podcasts. Be sure to tune in next Wednesday.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.